Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, he's very careful about what he says about Putin. He has at times been fiercely critical. There's one time I quote in the book where he said that Putin's political party, which is called United Russia, was just as bad as the Communist Party under Brezhnev. He's criticized Putin for cracking down on free speech. But on the other hand, Gorbachev has said a couple of times that Russia almost needs a period of authoritarianism of the kind that Putin, well, at least in the beginning, was laying on. Now, why would Gorbachev say that? It's almost as if he learned the lesson from his own time in power that democracy in Russia will take much longer than he had hoped to come to be. There was one moment where he said, and I quote this in my book, he said, it may take decades for Russia to become a democracy. And he continued, it may even take the whole 21st century. Well, that's a hell of a thing for somebody to say who tried to democratize Russia in a few short years. I think, alas, he has come to realize in a way that he did not before that Russia was not ready then and probably isn't ready now and won't be ready for a long time for the democratic institutions that Gorbachev tried to introduce into the Soviet Union.
What makes for a great political leader? And did Gorbachev change the world? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with American political scientist, teacher and biographer, Dr. William Taubman, whose latest book, Gorbachev, His Life and Times, has just been published by Simon & Schuster, where Bill highlights Gorbachev always needed a response, praise, support, sympathy and understanding which served as a fuel for his vanity and self-esteem, as well as for his creative acts. Bill goes on to state that despite Gorbachev's extreme self-confidence, that he was a good man with decent moral instincts. So how did Gorbachev become Gorbachev?
Hello, my name is William Taubman. I'm the author of a new biography of Gorbachev. It's called Gorbachev, His Life and Times. It's really the first full and comprehensive biography of Gorbachev. And it's the second biography of a Soviet leader that I've written. My first was about Nikita Khrushchev. And both of them actually were reformers. Khrushchev, of course, fell from power, as did Gorbachev. And that may say something about the resistance of Russia to reform.
Really well done on the book, Bill. I have to say it was a phenomenal read, not in terms of its expanse, but some of the ideas that you throw out as well. And what really jumped off the page, it seems, was that Gorbachev had quite a personality and quite a sense of humour. You open the book in a very intriguing way. You open the book with the words of Gorbachev. I think he said it to you, referring to himself in the third person. I think it was around 2005. And he said something on the lines of, Gorbachev is hard to understand. And it's a very intriguing comment, isn't it?
Well, you know, when I heard it, he said it to me in the intermission of a concert that I was attending. It was a concert in his honor. And he said, I've been working on the book for a year. He said, how is it going? I said, slowly. I said it apologetically. And he said, that's all right. Gorbachev is hard to understand. And I laughed. He has a sense of humor. But I knew immediately when I heard those words that I would use them in my book and that they would probably appear, as they do, as the first words in the introduction. I thought to myself, there are two possible meanings, related meanings to what he said. First of all, it's hard for other people to understand Gorbachev. But the even more intriguing possibility was that Gorbachev found himself hard to understand. And I think both things are true.
Bill, I'm just wondering, why do you think it is that the world is so deeply divided when it comes to understanding and looking at the legacy of Gorbachev? Because in the West, he's seen as a bit of a hero and somebody who opened up the Soviet system. Yet in his own country, he's seen as somebody who brought about the collapse of the Soviet Union. So I'm just wondering, how do you explain that?
Well, I think you've just explained it, actually. That is, we admire him in the West because he, in effect, destroyed what was left of Soviet totalitarianism. And he introduced the basic framework for democracy in Russia. That is, a free election, a functioning parliament, and free speech. Now, that hasn't lasted, unfortunately. That's another question, which we might get to if you want. But in Russia itself, a lot of people resented the fact that, first of all, the economy got worse rather than better, and then the system collapsed. The country disappeared. The Soviet Union disappeared along with its empire. It ceased to be a great power, and it turns out that Russians value that. They want to be a great power. They miss their empire, and so they greatly resent Gorbachev. Most of them do.
Some of his political aides and opponents absolutely despised his self-confidence and his self-belief. And while that's very, very clear, from reading through the biography, it seems that, you know, in one way you could see that maybe to a degree Gorbachev was a bit of a narcissist. But in another way, he was just a very radical thinker and a very driven man. So I'm just wondering, how sure of himself was he and how driven was he?
Well, you know, there was a Soviet psychiatrist who never treated Gorbachev, but who observed him closely and described him as a narcissist. Well, when I heard that word, it didn't sound right to me because, you know, we think of somebody like Donald Trump as a raving narcissist. Gorbachev wasn't like that at all, but he was indeed sure of himself, fully self-confident, overconfident, in fact, and I believe that that led him astray. It led him to think that he could democratize a country which had never known democracy in a few short years. It led him to think that he could control the communist hardliners who didn't like what he was doing. It led him to think that he could defeat Boris Yeltsin, who challenged him. And all of these assumptions turned out to be wrong. So in that sense, his overconfidence was a fatal flaw. But I'll say one more thing. It was the overconfidence that allowed him to attempt to reform his country in the first place. Others would have thought, no way, there's no way you can democratize a country like this. But he thought he could.
Do you not think, though, Bill, that you could put that charge at a lot of political leaders, whether it's looking at hubris, arrogance, amazing self-belief? Because most political leaders that come in have vision and they want to make change and they want to make change in their name.
That's true. I think Gorbachev had the advantage of being this kind of leader in a country in which he also had immense power. After all, this was still a fading totalitarian system in 1985 when he took over. And therefore, he had the kind of power that leaders in more open, pluralist, democratic systems don't have. He did not face constitutional constraints. He could operate without a rule of law. He tried to create a rule of law. So the system was more open to his making this grand attempt than it would have been in a more democratic arrangement.
You describe him as a remarkably decent man, and you say that decency showed in his family life. You met Gorbachev, Bill, I think it was about 8 times, and your wife is a well-known Russian language expert in America, and I think she helped you with a lot of the translations. I'm just wondering, your own good instinct, what did you make of him?
We liked him very much. We had these 8 interviews with him, about 2 hours each. And we found him to be remarkably natural, informal, warm, with a sense of humor. If I had interviewed more world leaders, which I have not, I could compare him. But I don't think, I just can't imagine reacting the same way to, certainly to Donald Trump, to Charles de Gaulle, to Margaret Thatcher. I mean, there was something natural and easygoing about Gorbachev. He is a good man, a nice man, a decent man, too decent, I think, to have been the ruler of a country which is used to czars and dictators.
Bill, Neil, you have a very interesting quote that you go into detail on. It was one of Gorbachev's closest friends, and he described Gorbachev as insufficiently decisive and consistent. It's an interesting take, isn't it?
Well, it's something I don't necessarily agree with. I mean, Shakhmazarov knew him very well. Gorbachev tried to change his country and the world, and he largely succeeded. And he did it at great risk to himself. He might have been overthrown at almost any minute. Now, how can you describe that as indecisive? I think that was bold and courageous and decisive. But he was hesitant about particular policies at particular moments. He could never quite bring himself to opt fully for what was needed to create a market economy, for example, whereas he was much more decisive about opting for mostly free elections. So he was decisive about the main things, I would say, and hesitant about some of the means to get to the end to which he was committed.
It's interesting, Bill, when you think about the fact that when Gorbachev got into power, most Western leaders distrusted him and his country. Yet he was able to turn that entirely around, which is, it's incredible when you think about it. Do you think we could argue that he ended the Cold War?
Yes, I think it is absolutely fair to argue that. I mean, in this country, the United States, there are a lot of people who claim Ronald Reagan ended the Cold War, or at least that he deserves equal billing along with Gorbachev. I have a kind of thought experiment which proves my point. That is, let's say that that Gorbachev had been hit by a truck before he seized power, and so he never did. I think if Gorbachev had not been there and Reagan had tried to end the Cold War with somebody else, it would not have happened. Whereas, reverse this scenario, let's imagine that Reagan is not there and Gorbachev is trying to end the Cold War with, well, President George H.W. Bush. I think the Cold War would have ended. In other words, Gorbachev was the key to ending the Cold War. The American presidents cooperated with him, but without Gorbachev, they themselves would not have been able to end the Cold War.
It's clear from the book, though, that Gorbachev and Reagan got on very well. They naturally clicked. They had very good chemistry. And within all of that, then, you could argue maybe that they were lucky in that fact, because had they not got on, given all the other obstacles that they faced, you couldn't have imagined it going as smoothly as it did.
Well, you know, I read the transcripts of the Gorbachev-Reagan negotiations, and they were largely sterile. Reagan would keep making these banal jokes. Gorbachev would pretend to laugh, or was obviously... At one point, Gorbachev went back to talk to his aides after a meeting with Reagan, and he described Reagan as a primitive, as a caveman. So the question then, it becomes precisely the one you asked. Why did they get along so well? And I'd say one reason was that they agreed on a fundamental political point. They both wanted to abolish nuclear weapons. But more than that, even more than that, I think they clicked on a personal level. The personal chemistry, I think, reflected the fact that they were two similar people. They both grew up in humble beginnings. Even their marriages were similar. I have a couple of pages in my book where I describe and compare Reagan's marriage with Gorbachev's marriage. The two men were both optimistic, confident, even serene in a certain way. Their wives were both sensitive, vulnerable, and high-strung, more worried than their husbands about their husbands' careers. Now, I think they sensed that they were two of a kind, and they liked each other.
Bill, one of the chapters in the book that I really enjoyed was when you go into detail about Reza and the romance that they had in their college days. You know, they met in university. Their parents were from very different backgrounds, or very different family backgrounds, and I think both their parents were somewhat against them getting married. But they got married very young. They had such a committed and loving relationship, and it seems from how you've written the book that Gorbachev Gorbachev's life started and ended with her to a degree. And it got me thinking, could he have achieved everything that he achieved without somebody like Reza by his side?
No, I don't think he could have achieved what he achieved without someone like Raisa. I think this is, I imagine two profound influences she had on him. One, she was he describes her as a maximalist. And by that, he meant that she had principles which she refused to compromise. So that I think she drove him and pushed him. He describes himself as a maximalist in the beginning, but then he says he became a politician and had to learn to compromise. Well, I think sometimes he was right to compromise, sometimes he was wrong to compromise, but she was by his side all the time. He consulted her on almost everything. And by the way, that was probably a mistake to admit that to the Russian people, including a lot of Russian women who didn't think she had earned the right to be the co-president of her country. No one had elected her. So in this sense, she was part of his strength. The other way in which I think she buttressed him and supported him was that she loved him deeply, and she was a kind of emotional, at tough times, she comforted him, she supported him. She was a kind of emotional buffer for him. I don't think he could have survived all the pressures and all the slings and arrows thrown at him if she hadn't been there. And I would add this, that oddly enough, in the end, he was better able to slough off the criticism that came his way than she was. She was more vulnerable. She was more sensitive. And in the end, she was the one who suffered more from the troubles that the two of them encountered. I think, in a sense, she was a perfect first lady, a modern first lady. Russia, Soviet Union had never had one before. But temperamentally, she was unsuited for that role. And I think it took its toll on her health.
Raisa died at 67 from leukemia, and you quote a very moving statement that Gorbachev made, and it's unbelievably intriguing, and shows you what type of a man he really was. Gorbachev said something on the lines of, after she died, that I am guilty, I am the one who did her in.
Well, I think what he was saying was that he realized that he had pushed her to give up her career as an academic, to become, in effect, a political wife, to suffer all of the attacks that were directed at him, and in the end to be felled by them. I mean, the real tip-off, two things. In August 1991, when there was this famous attempted coup to oust Gorbachev, and he and she were held under house arrest at their villa by the Black Sea, she had a minor stroke from which she never really recovered. And then after he was ousted, he insisted on running for president of Russia in 1996 when she begged him not to and other friends advised him not to. And they were right. He ended up getting less than 1% of the vote, but she stuck with him through the whole campaign. He campaigned in 20 cities in 2 months. And in some of these places, people spat in his face. Or in one case, one person slapped him across the face, and she had to go through with all of this. She didn't have to, but she did. She had, earlier on, when he was the Soviet leader, before he was forced out of power, she had wanted him to retire. She told him that he had accomplished what he could, and now it was time for them to find a cottage by the sea and settle down, and he never would do that. So when he said, I am guilty, I'm the one who did her in, I think he had all of this in mind.
Do you think he will carry that guilt to the grave?
Well, I think he will. He has said, I've even heard him say this, that he would never remarry because she was still with him and that he would see her again in the afterlife. And this is even more striking from a man who insists he is and remains an atheist.
Gorbachev's grandparents suffered terribly under the Stalinist regime. I'm just wondering, what type of an impact did that have on Gorbachev? And how did that impact on his political vision, do you think?
I think Gorbachev's upbringing as a child had a great impact on him and on his political career. It was partly that he was a first-hand observer, although a child, to the terrors of the 1930s. He was born in 1931. His family suffered through a famine of the early 30s. He lost two uncles and an aunt to starvation. Both grandfathers were arrested in Stalin's purges and sent to the Gulag, although they both returned. He could see what a disaster collectivization had reduced the countryside to. So although he was a young person, he remembered all of these, and I think this helps to account for his profound anti-Stalinism, which, of course, was a major theme of his political life and of his reforms. But on the other hand, his upbringing was important in that in these terrible times, he had a happy childhood. It's hard to believe, but it's true. His father was a wonderful man. I learned this not only from Gorbachev, but from talking to other people who had known his father. His grandparents loved him. He was their favorite grandchild. He talks about them he talks about his father's tenderness. You don't usually hear Russian men described as tender. So what I imagine is that Gorbachev developed this sense of self-esteem, this optimism about the world, even in terrible times, this trust of other people, which is essential to a Democrat. I mean, what is democracy except rule of the people? And in trying to democratize of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev was trusting his fellow citizens. So I think his childhood is absolutely central to understanding the kind of man he became and the kinds of reforms he tried to carry out.
I know Gorbachev has described himself as a product of the Soviet system and its anti-product as well. It's an interesting combination, isn't it?
It's an interesting combination. I think I can explain it, although it sounds puzzling at the start. Clearly, he was an anti-product of the system in the sense that he became its gravedigger somehow or other, trained, indoctrinated, propagandized by the system. He saw through it and eventually tried to change it and did. So in what sense then was he a product of the system? Well, for a long time, as his heretical views began to evolve, and until then, he was a believer. And even after he turned against Stalinism, he was a believer in communism. That is, he was a believer that the original goals of communism, as Lenin had tried to implement them, were worthy of trying to recapture through his own reforms. He remains to this day a Leninist, or he insists he is. And there's one other sense, I think, in which he's a product of the system. The fact that he tried to change it overnight is a reflection of communism's own effort to change Russia overnight. Think about it. The Bolsheviks seized power in October 1917, and they tried to transform their country, and they believe they can do it, although it turns out they're wrong. Well, similarly, Gorbachev believed he could transform or decommunize his country. And looking at the way Russia looks today under Putin, you have to see that he was wrong, too.
In your introductions, Bill, you quote the Russian scholar Dmitry Furman, who stated he was the only politician in Russian history who, having full power in his hands, voluntarily opted to limit it and even risk losing it in the name of principled moral values. For Gorbachev to have resorted to force and violence to hold on to power would have been a defeat. When you look at the current leadership in Russia, and you've just mentioned there Putin, it was such a remarkable turnaround, wasn't it?
I think if you look back over 100, 200 years of Russian and Soviet history, Gorbachev is the great exception in so many ways. And this is a primary one. Russian history is filled with force and violence and bloodshed. And Gorbachev was passionately against all of those. So in that sense, Furman is right. At the very end, in the fall of 1991, when Yeltsin was about to administer the coup de grace to the Soviet Union, when Yeltsin and the presidents of Ukraine and Belarus Yellow Russia agreed to abolish the Soviet Union, Gorbachev could have attempted to mobilize the armed forces to save the Soviet Union, to save the democratic Soviet Union he had created. And he shrank from that. He shrank from that possibility. He didn't do that. And in that sense, I think Foreman is quite right, that for Gorbachev to have resorted to force and violence to hold on to power would have been a defeat. On the other hand, I don't think it felt like a victory when he acted to give up power peacefully rather than to try to hold on to it. In his heart, he may have known he was right, but I think he felt he'd been defeated, and in fact, he was depressed for months afterwards.
One of the very moving aspects of the book is how you describe how Gorbachev dealt with Yeltsin and how Yeltsin was constantly chipping away at Gorbachev's power base, and how they both played a kind of a tight strategy with each other and within their own plans. And it seems that Gorbachev had great tenacity in dealing with adversity, didn't he?
Well, he had great tenacity when dealing with adversity, but he created some of that adversity himself. And Yeltsin is the great example. I have a chapter about that, which I titled Two Scorpions in a Bottle. But the way I look at it is that Yeltsin was a very talented man, a natural politician, a very difficult man for anybody to deal with. So Gorbachev wouldn't have had an easy time with him under any circumstances. But there was something about Yeltsin that rubbed Gorbachev the wrong way, as if he kept doing things that Gorbachev couldn't stand. And instead of fluffing this off, of dismissing it, of brushing him away, Gorbachev took the bait and fought back in a way that hurt Gorbachev more than it hurt Yeltsin. The key moment was in October 1987, when Yeltsin first began to criticize Gorbachev. And Gorbachev at first tried to say, let's listen to Yeltsin, let's hear what he has to say. But then Yeltsin goaded him into a very nasty attack. And this was at a Central Committee meeting, a Central Committee of the Communist Party. And Gorbachev opened the floodgates to others in the party who attacked Yeltsin for 2 hours, raging insults and attacks on Yeltsin, which Gorbachev then joined. Gorbachev humiliated Yeltsin, which only led Yeltsin all the more to plan to humiliate Gorbachev when he got the chance, which he did. And others around Gorbachev could see this. They could see that he was digging a hole for himself while trying to dig one for Yeltsin, but they couldn't get him to back off. It was as if Yeltsin had pressed his button in a way that Gorbachev couldn't stop trying to humiliate Yeltsin, and it backfired in the end.
It makes for a riveting reading, and it got me thinking that possibly Yeltsin resented Gorbachev's intellectualism, his high principles. Like, they were very different political animals. And you can see why the Russian public liked Yeltsin, though, can't you?
Well, Yeltsin was more like a czar. You know, Yeltsin was big and gruff and loud, and he was the kind of strong leader that Russians seemed to prefer. Gorbachev was much more, as you say, intellectual, thoughtful. Gorbachev talked too much. It was explained to me by some of Gorbachev's aides that the reason that he talked so long was that he was trying to explain to his listeners what he was doing and why. And in this attempt to explain himself to them, he went round and round in circles, whereas Yeltsin's way of proceeding was to say, 3 points, first, second, third. Another important distinction between the two of them, Yeltsin had a feel for democratic politics, for electoral politics. Gorbachev, ironically, the man who introduced real electoral politics to the Soviet Union, wasn't as good at it. He wasn't as good at the electoral politics he introduced as he had been at the bureaucratic politics of the old totalitarian regime. Gorbachev knew how to maneuver in the Politburo, in the Kremlin, but he wasn't as good as we say in America on the stump, making speeches in the parliament or to the public.
You have a very amusing passage in the book when Gorbachev was having a very fancy lunch at Chequers with Margaret Thatcher. And it seems that Margaret Thatcher liked Gorbachev's style, though I don't think Dennis, her husband, was as enamoured. But when reading political biographies and you get a lot of heavy duty stuff, it's nice to get these colourful distractions.
Well, the Thatcher-Gorbachev relationship is fascinating. She was the one who first encountered Gorbachev in 1984 when he came to London before he was even the Soviet leader. And she took a liking to him, and it was mutual. He liked her. They liked arguing. I think they particularly enjoyed it when they were fiercely attacking each other's systems. There was some kind of connection there. And Gorbachev's foreign policy advisor, Anatoly Chernyayev, who was there at their meetings, describes it in a way that it's almost erotic. It couldn't have been, and it wasn't, but there was a sort of fascination between the two. They just enjoyed each other's presence.
Thank you.
Talks on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with American political scientist and biographer, Dr. William Taubman, whose latest book, Gorbachev, His Life and Times, has just been published by Simon & Schuster. I asked Bill about Gorbachev's personal relationship with some of the big political leaders of Europe, including the likes of President Mitterrand of France and Chancellor Helmut Kohl of Germany, and what the chemistry was like.
Well, in the case of Kohl, there was anti-chemistry. And it goes back to the fact that in, I think it was 1987, Kohl allowed himself to say in an interview that Gorbachev and his propaganda reminded him of Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist for Hitler. Well, Gorbachev, of course, was deeply insulted and wounded by this and took it as a sign, as it certainly seemed to be, of political hostility as well. And so it took him, after that, at least a year to warm up to Kohl when he realized that Kohl had really was a potential partner rather than an adversary. In the end, they became very close, and their closeness was an integral part of how the German question was solved, why Gorbachev approved of the reunification of Germany, and then, even more shocking, he allowed a reunified Germany to become or to remain a member of NATO. As for Mitterrand, I think Gorbachev liked him. Gorbachev thought of himself as a kind of intellectual. He had attended Moscow University. He was a great reader. And I think he saw, with justification, Mitterrand as an intellectual, too. And I think he, therefore, enjoyed being with Mitterrand. He enjoyed Mitterrand's respect, which Mitterrand was willing to express warmly. So I'll mention a couple of other leaders. I gather from both Gorbachev and his aides that his favorite interlocutor in the West was Felipe González, the Prime Minister of Spain, who was also an intellectual, but even more than that, a socialist. Gorbachev loved talking to him. He also greatly admired Rajiv Gandhi, the Indian Prime Minister, who was sophisticated and educated. But Gorbachev got along with most of the Western leaders. The irony is that the leaders he did not like and did not respect and did not even want to spend time with if he could avoid it were the leaders of the communist satellite countries in Eastern Europe. He hated Honecker of East Germany. He had no use for Zhivkov of Bulgaria. His unfavorite leader of all was Ceausescu of Romania. And that helps to explain, it's not the whole explanation, of why Gorbachev preferred to spend time on East-West relations, pursuing an end to the Cold War, rather than either buttressing or attempting to prod or to provoke the East European leaders into reform.
God, that's interesting that he didn't get on with Ceausescu, but it makes sense in one way, because what comes across so clearly from your biography is that, you know, Gorbachev was all about transformation, and he was all about changing all kind of heavy-handed, violent regimes. So he probably resented the leadership style of Ceausescu and how he was brutalizing his people.
And in a sense, Gorbachev missed a chance. Because, you know, if in the end the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the loss of the Soviet Empire did so much damage to Gorbachev in the eyes of his own people, you have to ask yourself, was there a way, was there a path to reforming communism in Eastern Europe before it could collapse? And this is debatable, it's speculative, but I think there was. And the most obvious place to have done it was in Czechoslovakia. Gorbachev went to Prague in 1988, and before he went, his advisors thought they had convinced him when he was in Prague to disavow the Soviet intervention in 1968 that crushed the Prague Spring. But when he got to Prague, he didn't do it. Now, if he had done it, one could speculate that that would have brought back power Alexander Dubček, the leader of the Prague Spring, and Dubček might have been able to stabilize a reformed communist system in Czechoslovakia. But Gorbachev didn't do it, and the result was, in the end, of course, communism crumbled in Czechoslovakia. Václav Havel became the president, and this was part of the collapse of the East European sphere of influence. So why didn't Gorbachev do it? Well, we don't really know. He says he didn't do it because he believed in non-interference in the affairs of other countries. But that doesn't ring quite right to me, because after all, the Soviet intervention in the Prague Spring was the classic case of interference. So by disavowing it, he would have been proclaiming non-interference as his own principle. I really do believe this, that in the end, he just couldn't be bothered with these clowns who were the leaders of East European countries.
You mentioned a while ago there about the August coup of 1991. It seems that, you know, Gorbachev was a very resolute sort of a fellow, and he was well able to hold his nerve. So it must have been very difficult for him to finally face up to the fact that he needed to resign. And he must have felt so betrayed by some of his supposed political allies and friends. But I suppose he had to be pragmatic.
Well, this was a sign of Gorbachev's weakness. In the weeks before that August 1991 coup, he was warned that conspirators were planning to move against him. There was one very interesting moment when the Americans warned him. When the American ambassador, Jack Matlock, requested a private, secret interview with Gorbachev and relayed word from President Bush that the Americans were convinced that there was going to be a coup attempted against Gorbachev. And Gorbachev brushed it off, and he said, no chance, no chance. And the reason he did was reflected, again, the overconfidence that I was talking about a while ago. That is, he said, he didn't say this to Matlock, but he said this to his aides. He said, these people are supposedly plotting against me. They need me more than I need them. That is, he was convinced that they were mediocrities who couldn't cope without him. And this was a few weeks before they tried to get rid of him.
I'm just wondering, you've met Gorbachev 8 times with your wife in the putting together the research for the book. Have you got any feeling of regret? Or did he ever talk about regrets with you when he looks back at his political career?
Gorbachev admits that he made mistakes. He insists on it, in fact. And the mistakes that he admits to making were indeed serious. But I don't think they were the key to his downfall. One of them is he says he should have run for president of the Soviet Union in 1990 in a general election. Instead, he opted to be appointed president by the parliament. If he had run in a general election, that would have given him the kind of legitimacy, popular legitimacy, that Yeltsin got it the next year, 1991, when he ran for president of Russia, the Russian Republic, and won. And the other mistake that Gorbachev admitted to making in our discussions was he said he should have broken earlier with the Communist Party. That is, he waited until after it tried to break with him in the August 1991 coup. He was being urged to break with the party by his aides. They told him, look, you break with them, join with the Democrats, join with Yeltsin, and you'll take the country with you. But his view was that the party was his greatest danger and threat. They had ousted Khrushchev in 1964, and they might try to oust him. Therefore, as he put it, they're like a rabid dog who has to be kept on a tight leash. Well, I'm not sure that, I'm not sure that was such a mistake, because let's imagine that he broke with the Communist Party in 1986 or 87 or 88 or 89. Isn't it conceivable that they would have then moved to oust him and would have succeeded, whereas they failed in the August 1991 coup? So he admits to mistakes, but I don't think they're as central. The other mistake that he admits to, I think, is more important. He says he was overconfident, and I see that as the major mistake, his overconfidence that he could prevail in a desperate struggle in which, in the end, he was the loser.
Bill, it's interesting that Gorbachev has maintained his high-profile global position as the international statesman. And, you know, you go into a lot of details how he's involved with several charities with his daughter and so on. But it's interesting, he's very careful what he says about Putin, isn't he?
Well, he's very careful about what he says about Putin. He has at times been fiercely critical. There's one time I quote in the book where he said that Putin's political party, which is called United Russia, was just as bad as the Communist Party under Brezhnev. He's criticized Putin for cracking down on free speech. But on the other hand, Gorbachev has said a couple of times that Russia almost needs a period of authoritarianism of the kind that Putin, well, at least in the beginning, was laying on. Now, why would Gorbachev say that? It's almost as if he's learned the lesson from his own time in power that democracy in Russia will take much longer than he had hoped to come to be. There was one moment where he said, and I quote this in my book, he said, it may take decades for Russia to become a democracy. And he continued, it may even take the whole 21st century. Well, that's a hell of a thing for somebody to say who tried to democratize Russia in a few short years. I think, alas, he has come to realize in a way that he did not before that Russia was not ready then and probably isn't ready now and won't be ready for a long time for the democratic institutions that Gorbachev tried to introduce into the Soviet Union.
Last question for you, Bill. How should history remember him? And is it too much to say that he is should be remembered as a bit of a tragic hero?
I think he was a tragic hero. I mean, he was a hero in the sense that what he tried to do was worthy and noble, to change his country, to democratize his country, to end the Cold War, to bring about an era of peace in the world in which the use of force would be minimized. All these were noble goals, and he half achieved some of them. But what's tragic is that he failed, that he was ousted, that Russia reverted back in some ways under Putin to what Gorbachev had tried to change. But the most tragic thing, I think, is personal, and that was the death of his wife from leukemia and the sense that Gorbachev has that he was responsible for pushing her too hard. I don't think he's ever gotten over that. I should add that his most recent book is called, in Russian, Остаюсь оптимистом, I Remain an Optimist. And I guess he does at a certain level. That is, it's almost natural to him, almost genetic, to be optimistic about the world. But I think in his heart of hearts and late at night as he lives mostly alone in his villa outside of Moscow, he must be unhappy. He must be unhappy. I hope he isn't, because I admire him, but he must be.
Thank you.
And that was American political scientist, teacher and biographer Dr. William Taubman. Gorbachev, His Life and Times is published by Simon & Schuster and retails for just under €18 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Keith Thompson, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the perceptive words of the great Russian novelist and short story writer Dostoevsky, who once quipped, "Power is given to only those who dare to lower themselves to pick it up. Only one thing matters, one thing, to be able to dare." Fine words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.